Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 12.
No one's getting shot, Len said emphatically, but it might be a crime to let these cinnamon rolls get cold without eating one. That ended the discussion and everyone returned to their jobs. Len wiped frosting from his lip and leaned forward as the first residents started to filter in for breakfast. Do you think there's a wife out there, mad enough to try to kill Sheila? He asked. I don't think so, Len. Sheila doesn't seem interested in a long-term relationship with anyone, so it's not like she's stealing any husbands. Besides, getting a divorce is easy these days. If a wife can prove that her husband has been cheating on her, I'd bet she would come out on top morally and financially. What other motives have you heard about? Len asked. Nothing worth killing someone over unless they're really psychotic, I replied. Give me some examples. Sheila's chronically late for concerts and skips rehearsals. She dresses provocatively and flirts with the guys. I don't know, maybe it's because she doesn't show up until everyone is already tuned and the whole band has to wait for her. It's got to be something really stupid or invisible. Chronically confused, Hulda Packer, flamboyantly wearing a dress with plumeria flowers printed over it, heard part of the conversation and wheeled over. Sheila plagiarizes. With that, she was gone. Len looked confused. Plagiarizes? Hulda often can't come up with the right word. If you recall, she was the woman who told us that Axel had been killed because he was a philatelist when she meant philanderer. So what do you think she meant when she said that Sheila plagiarizes? Len asked. I can't even think of a word that sounds like plagiarize. From the back corner, Wendy chimed in, I need a 10-letter word that ends in E-N-T. That means go around. Circumvent, I replied. Does she do that often? Len asked. Anytime she's working on a crossword and I'm within earshot, I replied. How often do you know the correct word? I shrugged. Most of the time. Why do you know all those answers? Stupid stuff gets stuck in my head and I can pull it out, I said. How about pulling out a stupid motive for murdering Sheila? Plagiarizing is about as stupid a motive as I can furnish. Len rose from the table and reached for his pipe. I've got to ponder plagiarizing for a while. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 23. Things more pressing than Sheila's safety were calling me. I didn't have bingo set up. The natives would be restless. It was time to get back to work. The computer monitor was the centerpiece of my office, a pylon of clarity amidst the piles of papers. Although the office gave the appearance of chaos, I knew where each piece of paper was buried in each pile. On the other hand, the computer was a tool that served me well most days and drove me crazy on others. I shut it down at the end of each day and fired it up each morning. I was concerned when I could hear Stars and Stripes Forever playing as I approached my office. When I opened the door, I was staring at a Marine Corps band, there are several, displayed on my computer monitor. As the song hit the 2-minute mark, three Marines in dress blues came forward crisply with piccolos for their solo. As they began to play, my face suddenly appeared on each of their bodies. I recognized my picture from the Whistling Pines website. Someone managed to Photoshop it into the video. Wendy, I yelled, seeking out the most likely culprit. She caused and solved most of the computer problems, having the most expertise in the facility. She also, like an arsonist, wanted to be around to see the fire. What? She replied magically, appearing at my door. Make the Marines go away. They're playing the National March of the United States. I know. Make them go away. By this time, the opening bars of the song were restarting in a new loop. She sat in my chair, her fingers flying over the keys. "You didn't like the Bulls either," she said as the screen went blank, and then returned to the randomly twisting loops provided by the manufacturer as the default screensaver. "I thought you'd like to see what the Big Piccolo show was going to look like with you on the stage." "How did you do that? You were in the dining room the whole time we were talking about the Piccolo plans. How did you beat me back here and put the Marines on the screen?" Ignoring my question, she got up from the desk chair and said, "Mike Moore wrote a really cool sonata for the piccolo and piano. Maybe we can play that for Music Hour next week." I plopped into my desk chair and spun to face her. "My piccoloist days are over once Thursday's concert is over. Jenny says you're good. You should stay with it." "No, I turn in my piccolo license Friday." "You can't," Wendy said with a devilish smile. "You're on the city band roster now. Membership is perpetual, and if the need comes up for a director or piccolo, you'll get the call." "What? You're now a life member. Would you like to add any other instruments to your resume? I know that you play guitar and electric bass. There's not much call for them in the band, but I suspect that you also play some brass instruments." "No." Wendy shrugged and walked away. I quickly immersed myself in the minutiae of my job. Sheila's plagiarism never crossed my mind. I felt tired and realized that the early morning caffeine was out of my system. The computer clock said it was nearly 10 when I wandered back to the dining room for another cup of coffee. The morning breakfast rush had cleared, and Barbie was resetting the tables for lunch. At a corner table overlooking the lawn sat one of the newest residents with Scooter Arneson. Any assisted living facility has turnover. People leave for more acute care like a nursing home or move closer to their children or family. Some die. It's a never-ending cycle that throws new personalities into the mix on a monthly basis. Just on the basis of longevity, the majority of the residents are always women, and it's somewhat of a novelty when a new male resident arrives. After the unfortunate death of Axel Olsen a few months earlier, and the resulting relocation of Snuffy Saarinen, who killed Axel, we got a new male resident, Clarence Speedy Putnam. All the old-timers had nicknames, and Speedy had been the shortstop for the high school and Two Harbors baseball teams in the late 40s. Local lore said he still held the school record for the 100-yard high hurdles and stolen bases, although it was hard to visualize the now starkly slender man as a star athlete. Speedy was having a discussion with Scooter, who was known in his days as a speed demon hot rod driver who could drive and repair anything mechanical. Now he roamed the hallways driving a red Victor motorized scooter with yellow flames painted on the sides. His scooter was parked beside the table where he was making an emphatic statement to Speedy. It sounded like I was just catching the end of a long negotiation. But Speedy, the boat would be perfect. It's a Lund 14-footer, and the Johnson outboard motor purrs like the day it was built. "I need a boat like I need a spare set of dance shoes," Speedy replied. "It'll make us even for that Ford pickup you sold me with the blown engine." "You knew the engine was blown, and you told me you had a spare," Speedy replied. "Besides, I practically gave you that pickup. You only paid me $50 for it." "Well, this Johnson really pushes that boat along," Scooter said. "It's a thing of beauty, and it's just collecting dust in my neighbor's garage." "I don't need a boat. The kids sold all my fishing gear in a garage sale when I moved here, and it's not my problem that your old neighbor wants you to get the boat out of her garage. You've got a grandson who probably fishes a lot. Maybe you could buy the boat for him," Scooter suggested. Speedy just shook his head. "I'm not that generous." I brought my coffee to the table and sat in an empty chair. "Good morning, guys." Scooter leaned back, giving me a look that said he was unhappy to have the negotiation interrupted. Speedy smiled and looked relieved. "What's new in the outside world?" Speedy asked. "Well, the county fair is over and the city is going back to normal," I replied. "We've got a load of folks taking the van down to the Bandshell Thursday night for the last concert of the season." I could see Scooter staring into space, trying to remember something. Then he said, "I heard the conductor broke a leg and you were taking over. Funny that they always tell actors to break a leg, and here the conductor actually did." "What happened to Sheila O'Keefe?" Speedy asked. "I heard she got food poisoning and almost died from eating a bad hot dog at the fair." "She had a bad reaction to a peanut," I explained. "Someone knew that she's allergic to them and put one into the bottle where she keeps the reeds for her bassoon." "Huh," Speedy replied. "She's a fine-looking woman. I would have taken her out for a cup of coffee and a slice of pie in my younger days." Scooter was shaking his head. "Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker," he quoted. His reputation as a heavy drinker was well known, and he lost his driving privileges several times after being arrested for drunken driving. It was also rumored that he'd been a bit of a ladies' man and hadn't been choosy about the marital status of his partners. Howard Johnson walked to the table and sat in the fourth chair. Howard's dress slacks were freshly pressed, unlike Scooter's blue Dickies work pants and Twins t-shirt or Speedy's jeans and plaid flannel shirt. "Sheila has a bit of reputation around town," Howard offered. "I suppose some jealous wife tried to send her a message." "Hulda Packer said she had plagiarized something, and that was why she was targeted," I said. All three gave me questioning looks, but Speedy said, "Hulda's about as loony as a robin that's been eating fermented mountain ash berries." "Fermented berries?" I asked. "The robins fly into windows and trees when they've eaten mountain ash berries after the first frost," Speedy explained. "The berries crack when they freeze, and then yeast gets inside the fruit and ferments the sugar. The birds get drunk eating them." "She gets her words twisted," Howard replied, "but she often knows what's going on. She thinks Sheila did something at the fair, causing the attempt on her life." "She showed up late for the concert," I noted, "so all the other musicians had to wait while she assembled and tuned her bassoon." "It's something to do with her round heels," Scooter said. "What are round heels?" I asked. "If a woman was easy to get into the missionary position, people said she had round heels," Howard said with a hint of a smile. I think Hulda heard that something besides sex was the motive, but she couldn't come up with the right word. "Sheila copied something or stole the rights to something?" I asked. "Maybe she misrepresented her ownership," Howard replied. I thought about my trips through the 4-H quilt displays and the comments I'd heard day after day about the judging, the biases that should or should not come into play when comparing the crafts. Sheila's quilt had won third place and, to my eye, was far superior to the quality of any quilt that fell lower in the judges' rankings. Third place was hardly taking the grand prize or even second place. "Sheila had a quilt that took third place at the fair," I said. "So what?" Scooter asked. "That 4-H stuff is just for the kids. I don't even know why they let adults compete." I looked to Howard for a comment. After a few moments of thought, he asked, "How would you plagiarize a quilt? Did she steal a pattern from someone?" "It was a bassoon design with notes coming out of the bell," I replied. "There wasn't anything else like it." "Ahem," I heard, and turned to see who was behind me. Nancy, the director, was giving me a menacing look. "Just taking a break," I replied, getting up from the table and drinking down the last of my coffee. "Sheila O'Keefe has been trying to reach you," Nancy said as we walked out of the dining room. "When the receptionist kept getting your voicemail, she asked me to track you down and pass on the message." She handed me a post-it note with Sheila's name and cell phone number. Without breaking stride, Nancy added, "I don't suppose Sheila has a business-related issue. She's in the city band, and I'm sure it's something related to tomorrow's concert." By the way, there has been a lot of buzz about me filling in as the director, and it's getting Whistling Pines a lot of good press. I hoped that would resonate well with the director, who liked Whistling Pines to get free advertising. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 24. I tried Sheila's cell phone number, and it rolled over to voicemail, where I left a message saying I was returning her call. As soon as I hung up, the phone rang again. The caller ID said Howard Chapman was calling, and it took me two rings to realize that Jenny's father was on the line. I'd never spoken to him other than at the restaurant. "Mr. Chapman, how are you?" "First of all, please call me Howard. Second, you should come over for supper tonight." Howard reacted to my speechlessness as reluctance and added, "Barbara is making a Yankee pot roast, and it's the best meal she makes, other than her Thanksgiving turkey dinner. Pot roast is one of my favorites, and I haven't had it since I was a kid. I'd love to have dinner with you. We eat early, so why don't you come over at 5, and we'll have a drink while Barbara finishes off the side dishes." "Can I bring a bottle of wine?" I asked. "You don't need to bring anything but your appetite," Howard replied. As soon as Howard hung up, I called Anderson's flower shop and ordered an arrangement of whatever looked best and could be ready for pickup before my trip to the Chapman home. The rest of the afternoon flew by in a blur without a return call from Sheila. I expected Jenny to stop by and explain the sudden dinner offer, but she never appeared. Jenny had a cubicle in the corner of the relatively large health center where she and 5 other nurses and aides managed the medical needs of the residents. That ranged from maintaining the medical files on the most independent residents to administering drugs for those incapable of managing their own scheduled medications. Jenny was studying a file when I cleared my throat. She put her finger on the page to keep her place, then turned. "Hi," she said. "What's up?" "I'm going home to put on a clean shirt, then I'll see you for supper." "I don't think supper will work tonight. Jeremy has a math test tomorrow, and we need to do a lot of review. Your father called a little while ago and invited me over for Yankee pot roast." Jenny stared at me for a few seconds, awaiting some sign that I wasn't serious. "He said to be at the house at 5 because you eat early," I added. "Amazing," Jenny said. "I was going to stay late because the gerontologist was here today, and I have a pile of charts to update with his notes. Dad picks tonight to invite you over for dinner. I guess no one thought to ask me if it was okay to invite my boyfriend over." "I'm sorry," I said. "I could have run down right after he called to give you a heads up, but I thought you were probably in on the planning." Jenny slammed the chart, a 3-ring red binder, closed and slipped it into a pigeonhole over her desk. "I suppose I should run home so I can change into something that's not splattered with blood, sputum, and heaven knows what other bodily fluids." She took a key ring from her pocket and locked her desk and the gray steel case above her desk where narcotics were stored. "Look, if this is a problem, I can call up and trump up an excuse," I said, backpedaling as Jenny stepped out of her cubicle. "It's not your problem, Peter. Come on over. Maybe you can even help Jeremy. Long division was never my strong suit." Whistling Sousa, Chapter 25. I arrived at the Chapman doorstep with a mountain of anxiety. I was reaching for the doorbell when the door swung open and Barbara appeared. She looked at the flowers and I pushed them toward her. "Thanks for the dinner invitation," I said, presenting the flowers to her. "Oh, dear," she said, accepting the flowers and tilting her head to examine the bouquet. "This is so large it won't work as a centerpiece. It would interfere with conversation. I'll have to put them on the sideboard." She started to turn and then looked over her shoulder to say, "Thank you. They're very pretty." As an afterthought, she added, "Howard is in the dining room." Overhead, I heard galloping, and within seconds, Jeremy was hurtling down the stairs. He raced past me and looked around the floor. "Where's your guitar?" he asked. "I didn't bring it in." "Go get it. I want you to show Grandpa that riff you played for me. The one you said the doors did for light my fire. When I hesitated, he said, "Never mind, I'll get it for you," and he flew out the door toward my car. "In here," Howard called from a room down the hallway. I slipped off my shoes and was in the dining room when Jeremy slammed the front door and came racing in behind me as I was shaking hands with Jenny's father. The dining room was big enough for a comfortable dinner with a dozen people. The furniture was dark oak that stood on the same plush white carpeting as in the hallway. The room smelled of furniture polish, and trails from recent vacuuming tracked the carpet, making me feel even more sure that having me over for dinner had caused Barbara a great deal of trouble. Howard handed me a lowball glass with two ice cubes and dark liquid. A little bird told me that you enjoyed Jack Daniels, so I picked up a bottle this afternoon. There was a small fold-out bar against one wall, and Howard took up a martini glass with clear liquid and an olive from the marble bar top. "Cheers," he said, lifting his glass to mine. I took a sip of the unusually smooth whiskey. I looked at the bottle and saw it wasn't a typical Jack Daniels I bought, but was an 18-year-old special reserve, the kind that was kept in a locked case in the liquor store. The cost was way over my budget, and the fine aged liquor was better quality than my palate could appreciate, although I was touched by the gesture. Jeremy had put my guitar case on the floor in a corner of the room, and he was quickly releasing the latches. He gently took the guitar out of the case and held it like it was something magical. He carefully crossed the room with it and held it out to me, explaining to Jenny's father, "It's a Martin acoustic six-string, the same kind that professional musicians use when they make their unplugged albums." "I don't know that your grandpa wants a music session right now, Jeremy," I said, gently taking the guitar from him and holding it by the neck. "We have a little time before supper's ready," Howard said, taking my glass. "Go ahead and play something." I sat in a high-backed chair and tuned for a few seconds and then asked, "What would you like to hear? If I've heard it, I can usually play it." "Yeah, Grandpa, Peter said that he sat around nights in Iraq just playing whatever the Marines wanted to hear. He can play anything." "Can you play something from the 60s? Howard asked. I played the guitar riff from American Woman by the Guess Who, and then slid into Classical Gas, an instrumental piece written and recorded by Mason Williams. When I ended, Howard's mouth was agape. "Wow," he said. I looked up. Jenny was standing at the dining room door. She'd changed into white shorts and a pink T-shirt. I could tell she was pleased that I'd impressed her father. "Play Autumn Leaves," she said. I'd played a few bars when Barbara rushed into the room with tears in her eyes, stopping at the door and looking like she'd seen a ghost. I stopped and we all stared at her for a second. She motioned for me to keep playing, then slid under Howard's arm as I restarted. I'd never seen her face express any emotion, yet she was sobbing into a tissue by the time I finished the second verse. Unsure what I'd caused, I got up, set the guitar in the case, and was shocked when I turned around and she hugged me, staining my shirt with tears. Without releasing the hug, she said, "My brother was killed in Vietnam. The night before he left, he sat on the porch and played that song to his girlfriend while I hid in the living room and listened." Barbara stepped back and held me by my shoulders. Mom caught me sitting there and made me go to bed. He was on the van to Minneapolis before I got up the next morning. I never got to say goodbye to him. My last memory is him strumming his guitar and singing that song to Mary. Buzzer sounded in the kitchen, and Barbara quickly left. Howard joined her to cut the roast while Jeremy and I helped Jenny fill water glasses from a crystal decanter. While Jeremy was on the opposite side of the table, I whispered, "That was really odd. Did you know that would happen when you asked me to play that song?" Mom told me the story about hearing her brother singing to his girlfriend, and she'd mentioned autumn leaves. I knew it might be special for her, but I didn't expect the waterworks. I remembered sitting in the barracks with a dozen Marines singing along to songs they requested. I played the guitar and told some jokes to help everyone decompress from the daily grind of driving around, making contact with the locals, while constantly worrying about being blown to pieces by an IED under the next pile of rocks along the road. All of us were on edge all the time, and playing video games or guitar were about the only breaks from the harsh reality of life in the blowing sand. "Hello, Earth calling Peter," Jenny said, bringing me back to the dining room. "Supper will be on the table shortly." "Sorry," I said. Jenny handed me 2 crystal red wine glasses, and I set them on the table. Howard delivered the pot roast on a huge platter, surrounded by potatoes, carrots, and pearl onions. Barbara, who had removed all of her tear-stained makeup, came in with a gravy boat. I took the gravy boat from her and set it on the table. She was standing uncomfortably close to me when I straightened up. Barbara put her hand on my bicep, pulled me close, and kissed my cheek, whispering, "Thank you," in my ear. I said it was my pleasure, realizing it was the first time I'd ever seen her without makeup, and I could see how much Jenny resembled her. Jenny poured red wine into glasses for the adults, while Jeremy dove into the pot roast platter, spearing the largest piece along with several browned potatoes. As we ate, Barbara showed a soft, funny side I'd never seen before. She seemed like a different person and laughed out loud when Jeremy tried to tell a knock-knock joke and botched the punchline. I wondered if she'd been nipping the cooking sherry. "Your mother is very colorful," Barbara said, politely understating her true feelings about mother. "Will we see her at the band concert tomorrow night?" I haven't told her about it, I managed to filter my first thought. I was glad she wasn't coming. I didn't need the drama when I was already stressed to the limit. "I could give her a call," Barbara offered. "That would be nice," I replied, trying to sound upbeat while my stomach churned. "But my mother's life is usually full, and she doesn't respond well to disruptions to her routine. I doubt that she'd miss another performance of her son as the band director. I'll give her a call in the morning," Barbara said. Jenny studied my face for a reaction, but I managed to suppress the grimace I was feeling. "I won't have much time to socialize," I countered. "That's okay," Howard said. "We'll bring an extra chair, and we'll keep her entertained until the concert is over." "Thanks," was all I could say. We made small talk by talking about my arrival in Two Harbors, Jenny's growing up in Two Harbors, and Jeremy's struggles with math homework. Howard loved his job and made enough money that Barbara was able to be a stay-at-home mom and grandmother who took pride in keeping the house spotless, the gardens weed-free, and the lawn manicured. Every aspect of their lives was orderly and neat. It was the exact opposite of life growing up with my mother.
The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.